Spill milk.
Yo, welcome back to another episode of the Spilt Milk Podcast. I'm IR Him. I want to say thank you so much to everybody that has subscribed, everybody that's been tuning in, everybody that has donated. And if you haven't yet, please go ahead and leave us a 5-star review. All you got to do is scroll down right at the bottom. You see the 5 stars. Click on the 5th one. But without further ado, we're going to go ahead and introduce our guests. Who's with me today?
Yo, you already know who it is. It's the one and only. It's the chosen one, baby. It's FB in the house. And we got an amazing sister that's doing amazing work in the community, in the metro area, Minneapolis. We're in the presence of a real one. You feel me? A giant, a leader, a true leader. You feel me? Not just like a fake one. This is reality right here. There's no Matrix shit. This is the truth. You feel me? Runta. You dig? What's your name?
I thought you were going to do the poetry connection.
No, I got you. I want the people to actually hear you.
Yes.
And not pronounce your full name.
Yes.
What's your name?
My name is Kosar Muhammad.
Kosar Muhammad, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. So excited.
Thank you for joining us. So we're going to jump right in. So we want to have a part two of the conversation about gentrification. But we want to address it from the standpoint of why do residents have the right to choose to continue to live where they live? Gentrification always begins with a sense of value. If you don't think a place has gold, you won't go digging for gold. And usually, value is attached to a symbol. But for the sake of our conversation, the symbol could be a neighborhood. Now, how do we associate ourselves with value? I'll give you guys an example. You have this high school girl. She's innocent, she's mesquite, she's new to high school, and there's this guy, the junior captain of the football team.
Oh, man.
Dangerous.
And the junior captain of the football team approaches this mesquite freshman, sweeps her off her feet. And after a couple of weeks, she decides to be in a relationship with this guy. So usually, well, I shouldn't say that, but she enters this relationship wishfully that this can continue and further bring the warm butterfly fuzzies that she always thought she deserves to have. But oftentimes, with no communication and stated intentions, everything is lost in translation. So when you enter a healthy relationship, you feel your self-worth. It shows up on your smile. Your self-worth shows up on your skin. But if a relationship is unhealthy, everyone can tell because of the bags under your eyes. You're always in a pissy mood, or maybe people see the bruises on your arm from it being twisted a little too hard. Now, I didn't tell you guys what happened to the high school innocent girl, but naturally, we made a prejudgment that probably her heart is going to be broken. And when it comes to gentrification, our neighborhoods are always left with broken hearts. And I want to loop back and say, how do we associate the self-worth of our neighborhoods, and do we as residents have the right to choose to continue to live where we live?
What do you think, Kosar?
That's deep, right?
So, that was a really deep.
Right.
Thank you for doing that. That was you really gave me a picture of this high school girl that's really lost, and I feel like, damn, now my community is lost, and I need to save her from this, you know, football captain.
Right. I think that always gets me back to thinking, how do we circumvent the negative outcomes of gentrification, right? And ultimately, what is gentrification? Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes we forget the systems and the barriers that exist ultimately in the institutions that we're a part of, right? Mm-hmm. And the institutions that overall defy what our being and our existence and our agency and space is. But to really even simplify it, what is gentrification? Really understanding the root of this, the root of gentrification, the root word gentry translates to well-born, well-bred people that are gentle, right? In historic times, I believe the 17th, 18th century, when it was defined, it was for land-owning social class who are socially accepted. They were not noblemen, right? But they were those with coats of arms. So when we really recognize gentrification spaces that we're involved in, it's always political. It's never for those who have been marginalized. It's never for the working class. It has never been for those who are of black and brown bodies who've been marginalized in these systematic processes and have been unable to really break through because the policies and planning procedures set in place to develop gentrification to be what it is has never been for them, has never been for community. So ultimately, the result and the outcome will always be heartbreak unless we start recognizing what opportunities exist to circumvent those negative outcomes.
Do you feel like the people that live in these areas have the right to choose where they live?
They do, right? Because oftentimes these communities have already developed the authentic social economies around them. They've developed the networks. They've developed the opportunities and amenities that you see that really oftentimes highlight and attract developers to these areas. There are already existing resources that have been authentically created by community, for community, with community. So when developers come in, they're like, oh, I see this being a very low cost return on my investment to develop here. And I don't have to worry about or deal with, you know, the various issues around connectivity. I don't have to deal with mobility issues. I don't have to deal with, you know, scarcity of resources because they already have an abundance of resources because the systems work for them. And then with community and the residents who live there, they obviously feel like I have a stake at this, right? I've developed these amenities. I've been at the forefront of really launching a lot of these businesses. I've been at the forefront of fighting and mobilizing for community-oriented solutions that really help me in navigating this space. I guess one example is in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, community members had continuously, you know, fought for the rights to have two transit line access points, right? Where we have both the green line and the blue line perfectly situated in the neighborhood to help with mobility issues, right? For those who don't have access to an automobile and can't afford it, right? So why do these community members no longer have the voice or the agency to really voice what is going to be in their neighborhood, right? Why aren't they a part of these conversations around gentrification? And why can't they be? Why do they not have the right to really feel like I, as a renter, can't talk about property rights? They do have the utmost, they should have the utmost ability because community members are oftentimes the ones that are left out, but they are the experts of what the geography of that space is, what the amenities will be, how things will end up situating themselves. But the systems aren't there to work with them.
So when you have developers who, mm-hmm. a lot of people say, rightfully so, have the right to behave in an autonomous manner. They have the free will to do whatever they want to do because they have the money to buy and purchase these spaces. Right? So when it comes to them, they don't feel that there's a need to get into a relationship. They don't have to be committed. Mm-hmm. They don't have to value you because they have the money. Mm. And I oftentimes find myself thinking like, when it comes to these community problems and things of that sort, other communities have done it. What can we do to like put gaps or to make sure that we can enter healthy relationships when it comes to developers coming in and buying up these high risers and making sure that we don't get displaced? Because if we look at the Cedar community or the Carmel community or the St. Cloud community, for example, when I moved to Minneapolis, actually, I realized that you could literally live in Minneapolis and not speak a lick of English. Right?
Yes.
So your insurance broker is Somali, right? Your real estate agent is Somali. You go pay your T-Mobile bill to a Somali guy, right? So when you call to pay your electric bill, right, there's a Somali translator option. You know, mm-hmm. when you go to a hospital, you could get a translator to would go with you to the your hospital visits, or when you go see a pharmacist, you see a Somali pharmacist, right? So mm-hmm. there's an economy there, and it booms. Mm-hmm. We have a ton of successful business owners, right? There's this mm-hmm. group on Snappy right now where they're aggregating real estate investors in the community mm-hmm. in Minneapolis. Strong luxury, but if gentrification comes and people are displaced, how can you fuel an economy without people?
Right. And I think the piece in that conversation that I think developers and government alike and philanthropists will always refer back to is, well, you know, we'll increase awareness around public assistance opportunities throughout this development project, right? Regardless of what happens to you, we will help you in seeking vouchers in these X, Y, and Z suburban communities like Savage and Burnsville. And, you know, like these are second ring suburbs, right? That a lot of people who have lived in these urban enclaves have never experienced, right? Nor do they want to in many cases. So why do we always, I think, refer back to public assistance if we ultimately the goal is to have people out of public assistance? We don't want people utilizing public assistance. And we also recognize that folks who do live in these urban enclaves who are, you know, really honing in and understanding that they want to be surrounded by environments where their hospital is accessible to them, their school districts are accessible to them, to be able to be an ethnic enclave as well, where they're not only situated in an urban environment, but they're also situated in an environment that feels very authentic to their identity, right? That they define for themselves. But I think it's that piece of like, why do we always fall back on there's public assistance available if we no longer want those in marginalized communities to continue utilizing public assistance, right? There's nothing wrong with public assistance. I think the problem is, why do we continuously see, you know, Black and brown people and people from marginalized backgrounds utilizing public assistance for a long term and a long period? And it's because we're not changing the systems they're a part of, right? We're saying that you're going to stay at these low wage jobs. And once you're displaced out of your community and neighborhood, it's fine. We'll just find you another house, put you another public assistance voucher in a faraway neighborhood, and then place you back into another low-wage job. So it's just the cycle. It repeats itself. It just continues and reconstructs itself to continue to work for the oppressor and no one else.
So you think, because what I'm trying to put my head around is, yes, there's the word gentrification already brings some type of, we get tight when I hear that, right? Mm. I don't like that word already. And I think we're starting to realize that that word means trouble. That's like where white man tried to come to colonize and white man comes to take over. But I think when they're doing it in a way where you are in Minneapolis, for instance, or in a metropolitan, and then everything is so accessible to you, mm-hmm. but you're still on government assistance, mm-hmm. but they tell you we're going to displace you to go to Savage,
or Eagan or any other suburban cities who has funding, who has a better, from a government side, they have a better managerial side of actual funding, right? So they're like, every penny they give you, they're accounting for, like, okay, where, how much money do you have? And we need a report from you on a monthly basis and all of that, right? And we're going to help you find a job. So the resources are better in these suburban areas to some degree. Their schools are better. Would you say that displacing these people from a community vibe to go to another city that has better access to opportunity is still a disadvantage?
For sure, because it really depends on how you define opportunity, right? Coming from a more personal standpoint and growing up in an urban environment, growing up in an ethnic enclave, being very fortunate to be in those spaces, I think that being around the resources that I had, right, the authentic social economies that constructed itself, I was very lucky, right? Like childcare came to, it was most of the times at no cost, right? The school systems aren't always the best in urban areas, right? But it's the accessibility of it, right? I didn't need an automobile to get there. My mom didn't have to worry about, you know, what my access was going to look like for me to get to school. She knew that was guaranteed, right? She also knew that there were people in community going to that school with me. So she didn't have to worry about, oh, this child has to now re-navigate this entire space around culture, around heritage, around religion, right? I was very fortunate in the sense that I had people who looked like me, who spoke like me, who ate like me, who understood, you know, where I was coming from in many aspects and talked like me, right? But in the piece of like, you know, displacing people into the suburbs because the suburbs have greater opportunities, that's not a good excuse, right? Oftentimes, removing people from the areas that they recognize and they've always known actually sets them up to be in a disadvantage, right? It becomes a low return on the investment that they quote unquote were selling in the beginning.
So then, you know, a lot of the people, for instance, even my family or people that I know that have migrated or moved to Minneapolis, the first place they go to is Cedar, whether they're Eritrean, Ethiopian, you know, Somali, Oromo. It's like a melting pot for everyone that comes in. Now, the moment they feel like they're booming, everybody leaves this community. Mm. Now,
to me personally, that's...
You tell me, you just told me earlier that it's not necessarily an opportunity, but then when they feel like they make it, they leave. Then why would they leave?
That sounds like rappers. Mm. A lot of rappers in their music talk about, oh my God, I left the trap. I came out of the mud. For us, that doesn't really happen. The most successful people, they stay. And I personally, from my personal experience, I see a ton of extremely successful people that still live in Cedar, that still live in Carmel, that still live in all the neighborhoods that we are extremely aware of.
But you cannot deny that there's also a ton of successful people that leave that area for better opportunity for their kids.
But at what cost?
Right?
I think it's at a spectrum, right? I think that you guys both have a case, right? There's the situation of people who stay, right, in these neighborhoods that are really recognizing themselves as like, you know, this area is profitable for me. It's affordable. It's still connected in community. I can continue to flourish here, right? And then there are those who make the decision that, hey, I no longer feel like I can function here, right? And I have an opportunity and I have a choice to move out of this space for the quote unquote betterment of the lives of my children and myself, right? But in the case from what I've recognized and from what I've recognized in the neighborhood that I reside in, oftentimes those who leave are still continuously there. They still come every day because the halal is there, because their grandparents live there, because childcare is located there due to their banking systems. Like, so we all use money wiring and stuff like that. And that is all located in that Cedar Riverside neighborhood. And that's just in the case of, I'm speaking for the Somali community that I've had experience with, right? I'm not sure how other communities might navigate that space of like, you know, leaving the hood or and returning back to it. So it's very much on a spectrum. It just really matters about what place in that spectrum you're on. But I do see that those who oftentimes leave always return, and they always have regrets of, you know, I thought my child's life was going to be 10 times better, but you stayed and you turned out just fine. And, you know, I can't say the same for my kid, or I can't say the same for myself. And I'm always wonder, like, well, where was there an issue at contention? Where did we start working in silos? Did something happen when you moved there? And oftentimes it, from what I noticed, it relates back to the experience that they had around navigating that new space, right? There wasn't an easy, smooth process of really engaging with that new community.
So we're talking about the people that had the choice to leave. What about the ones that don't have a choice? And maybe they don't want to leave. And maybe they work or they own this little shop around Carmel, for example, and they are receiving a voucher. Landlord comes up and says, you know what, the company sold and we are no longer accepting vouchers. And if you want to continue to live here, instead of you paying $1,100 for this 3-bedroom, we're looking at about $1,800. And now this tenant, this grandma, this mom, this father, or this college student, in most cases, their arm is being twisted to like leave. How do we help alleviate that narrative a little bit?
Around the, so if I'm catching that correctly, around the narrative of those who reside in an area, work in an area, play in an area, pray in an area, how do we address the fact that if they still want to continue to live in a place, right? And there's displacement that's occurring, how do we support them? Is that what you're asking? Or
how do we stand by them?
So how do we stand by them, right? I think there's a lot of many ways to do it, but I think oftentimes it's through resistance. We see a lot of communities doing that, and resistance can be done in many ways. It's resisting regulation that pushes towards gentrification and that allows for the processes of developers to easily access communities that are low income, that are, you know, working class, that are marginalized in a way where they can do it at a low barrier cost, right? With no compliance added to it, no regard and no, you know, no requirements for community engagement. Oftentimes, community is told, you're not participating, you know, you're not part of the citizen participation board, you're not a part of the advisory board, you're not providing feedback. Like, feedback sessions occurred Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. But what if you work during those times, right? Like, what if you're not 24/7 present in community because you have X, Y, and Z things to handle and worry about, right? So I think one way that we can, I guess, help and support community during this process is really being able to educate ourselves, and not just educating community, but also educating those who are stakeholders in this work, really being able to do stakeholder inventory and mapping and recognizing who needs to be held accountable, right? Who's pushing these policies? Who's pushing these plans? Who do we see at the core and at the forefront of these conversations, and really calling them out for it? Oftentimes, it's a lot easier to say than do because we all have our own personal agendas. We all have our things to be worrying about, but sometimes it really becomes that piece of the public good and that value piece. How much do we value our self-worth, and how much do we value community worth?
Yeah. See, like, understanding the value of self-worth and then understanding the value of community, right? And you touched on earlier that, like, for the example in Cedar, they are very worthy, right? That's a strong community, has a high value. And gentrification, if were to take place, and may God forbid, but if were to take place, it would be impactful, huge. Now, my question is, in communities that is low income or whatnot, but nothing doesn't really have a strong bond of community like Cedar.
Mm-hmm.
Would gentrification be as impactful?
I think it would be as impactful anywhere, right? Because anytime you see the displacement of any body or any group and the exclusion of that group, you see the obvious, you see the obvious examples, right? One example that we could see of any community being displaced, and, you know, it was a very strong community, it still is a very strong community, is the Rondo neighborhood in St. Paul, right? That community has continuously dealt with systematic oppression and systemic racism, right? And they had, you know, this land grabbing situation where the government utilized the Federal Highway Act of 1956, I believe, to really be able to utilize eminent domain to land grab those areas, and redlining in addition to that also displaced that community. It got rid of their social economy, got rid of their entertainment district. It got rid of everything that those people have ever known, right? And caused those people to move out of the neighborhood and literally with no engagement from government, right? No engagement of the transportation services, no engagement with the federal government. It continuously wiped out an entire economic structure for what it was known at that time. And people are still now working towards rebuilding that community through the Reconnect Rondo initiative, through the Landbridge initiative, through various different initiatives to really be able to hone in and recognize how do we preserve and sustain the history of this community, and how do we return on upscaling and scaling up and uplifting this community to what it used to be. Because it's not that the people have died out. That's the biggest issue with this gentrification conversation, is that people act like community members die once a neighborhood is displaced. No, the people are still alive. The people are still fighting. It's just a matter of how long can you resist before you feel like you're breaking and you no longer have the ability to continue to fight the good fight. So that's one example of the community that has been fighting since the early 1900s till now, and continuously working towards systematic change and fighting oppressive services.
Definitely. And I think one rhetoric that is often used when a neighborhood is gentrified is they say that, well, look at the homeowners. The shops are accessible to everybody. You know, damn well, people are not going to afford to shop at a lot of these shops that will be popping up in gentrified neighborhoods. You know what I mean? And they say, the surrounding property value increases. How many of us are property owners? You know, that live in these neighborhoods. All of us rent.
Yeah.
And we're thinking and maybe are nervous about ways to potentially own property, but it's really rare to find somebody that looks like us that owns a house in our neighborhoods, you know? And with that being said, it's like, so what are we truly benefiting from this? Like they say, okay, like the example that you gave of potentially, oh, you get to go to this neighborhood and you have better education and you have this, that, and the third, but you lose on the culture, you lose on the sense of community. If something happens, you get sick and you can't take your kid to the hospital. Like the conversation we had earlier, Jill down the street, if you never want to go meet her and are not comfortable with her, you probably won't say, hey, Jill, can you take my child to the hospital? You're probably going to try to reschedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So with these conversations that we're having is, how do we know? Or it's kind of hard to hold a megaphone and yell down the street every day. Right? And these relationships are going to happen, right?
Right.
Communities and yuppies, young people with money, are going to come to a lot of neighborhoods that have character. And we're going to say, hey, you know what? This project building, I will buy it and I will change it into something else. Sometimes it's inevitable. Right. But if it is going to happen, how do we make sure that we're entering a healthy relationship? Or what would a healthy relationship look like?
Yeah, that's key. I think even relating back to that conversation that we had earlier about self-worth, right? And community value and being able to recognize that earlier on, I think that becomes a bargaining chip. Although oftentimes, like, it's like, why the hell does community have to bargain for their identity? Why do they have to bargain for what they've already sustained and preserved and created for themselves? But then that is where the conversation usually ends up becoming. This becomes a negotiation. You're negotiating for your livelihood and you're negotiating for your ability and your agency to still exist and survive in this space. I guess one example that I always come back to and think of is, how can we create equitable urban development, right? We like communities that are marginalized, communities that are coming from low income backgrounds, that are areas that are recognized as concentrated areas of poverty. It's not that they don't want economic development, right? It's just the types of economic development that are being told to them is what they're going to get. Like, you have no option. This is what you get. You can't have a fit. Like, there's no dialogue. There's no conversation of what are some community-led solutions? What are some community-led opportunities? What are some things that community can actually see as being tangible devices to utilize to create some economic prosperity in this area? It's never the conversation of economic prosperity, but it's really the conversation of economic opportunity and really honing in on what is your return on investment. And community isn't really a part of those conversations around return on investment, because that's not the concern for the developer. That's not the concern through policy and planning regulations. So I think the task for us at that point becomes, how do we mobilize ourselves in a way where our resistance processes are effective and we can actually fight off economic growth that is altering our neighborhood identity?
So, Kosar, I know you mentioned heavily on mobilizing, right? Mm-hmm. And coming together to stand and have a conversation. Now, initially, you say, you know, these developers that come in to gentrify the local government that are not standing by you, and they're coming in and they're not giving you a seat in the table to discuss. But that is, I'm looking at it, and correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. is it part of our blame that we don't have a seat in the table is because we are not mobilizing? We're not coming together as a community to actually own and claim our seat. And if, I don't know, is that are we to blame because we didn't claim our seat in the table? We're not even coming in together to have one voice, but rather we're divided.
I think you could say
the community is not to blame.
There's a difference between saying you should have learned better and saying, I know there's a seat at the table, but let me make sure that you are not aware that there's a seat at the table. Right? So, like, we don't, oftentimes, like, access is really a problem. We don't know these things. We don't know that, or it's hidden from us, essentially, that we can actually go and fight this. Right? It's like a cop. A cop could do whatever you want unless you know your rights. Right? So does that, is that our fault? Or is it the cop's fault for taking advantage of us for not knowing our rights? Is it the captain of the football team's fault for breaking this Mesquite girl's heart? Or is it the Mesquite girl's fault for being too Mesquite?
Well, you always have to protect your heart, right? So I think it's a both way that, yes, you blame the other person for taking advantage of your vulnerable point, but you also have to protect your heart and protect yourself and protect your community, right? We want to take a moment to really thank you, Kosar, who is an urban planner from the and honestly, it has been a pleasure. It has been enlightening. I've just been watching and listening, and this is a conversation that I hope you learned from. If you feel that your community is suffering from such circumstances, or that are facing or might potentially be an issue of gentrification, ask us to get you in touch with people that actually have experience with this conversation. Let us connect together. Let us mobilize and actually work together. Let us take advantage of voting. It's so many different things that we can take part of. Now, we can always say our parents didn't do it, but our parents came and they did other things. But it's always about you. You go and do what you got to do, and the rest you keep it to God.
And disrupt systems.
Disrupt systems.
All the time.
Yes.
All the time.
We are on 11 different platforms. We are on Spotify and Apple. Please leave us a review. 5 stars, nothing but 5.
5 stars only.
Yes.
5 stars only.
5 stars what?
5 stars only. Okay. Like, y'all gotta keep repeating that. Literally, it needs to be all your handles by now.
5 stars only. Write us a review if you can. And that really goes a long way. So please, yes. please.
Love is love.
A great philosopher once said, love is love. Peace and prosperity. Assalamu alaikum.